Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of April. All things political for this Monday with Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell. Our guest this hour, she is Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, author of Barbershops, Bibles, and BET, Everyday Talk and Black Political Thought. She's also working on a new book, Sister Citizen, a text for colored girls who've considered politics when being strong wasn't enough. She contributes frequently to MSNBC. She writes a column for TheNation.com, speaks all over really the world, and became the youngest scholar to deliver the W.E.B. Du Bois lectures at Harvard University. She is one busy woman, a divinity student, Master's of Divinity student at Union Theological Seminary in New York. We have a lot to talk about with her: financial reform, immigration reform, oil spills, and other issues that you will want to bring up. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that as well. That is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, thrilled to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Let's start with immigration reform and the law that was signed in Arizona last Friday by the governor of that state. And it is pretty controversial. It opens the way for another contentious debate, this time on immigration reform. What do you make of what they passed? What legal challenges are ahead? And will it hasten a national discussion on immigration?
Well, it's interesting because in certain ways it's not really substantive immigration reform. It doesn't change the rules about how people can be in the country or who can be in the country. Instead, it is a change in the enforcement of current immigration law. And I think it's that enforcement mechanism which is the thing creating kind of the most public anxiety about this. So again, in Arizona, the law that passed and was signed by the governor, is a law saying that individuals can be stopped and asked to produce proof of the legality of their presence in the country, and that can happen on a basis that is not connected to any other criminal concern. So in other words, you can simply be stopped based on identity rather than having immigration status checked as a result of some other contact with law enforcement. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that feels uncomfortably like sort of South African passport laws or during a period of enslavement when people had to carry free papers in order to prove that they were not to be sent back into slavery in the South. It brings up, obviously, the most disgusting and racist forms of racial profiling that are based on identity and appearance only rather than on anything that is behavioral. And so I suspect that we will, in fact, see legal challenges to this enforcement.
Those who are opposed to this, Melissa, say that Arizona officers would arrest people found to be undocumented, turn them over to federal immigration officers, and the federal government could block the law by refusing to accept them. Do you think that that will happen?
You know, it's an interesting question that will once again go right to the heart of states' rights. And it's interesting that just at this moment as, for example, the Tea Party movement is engaging in a sort of revival of states' rights language, that this particular law almost turns local law enforcement officers into agents of the federal government, right, having them enforce these federal laws and turn over folks to the federal government in this way. I don't think, simply because of sort of the history of how the American federal system works, that you're going to see federal agents acting as a kind of basis of mass democratic resistance against this law.
Right.
Instead, I think this is going to have to be resisted from the bottom up. In other words, I'd much prefer to see local law enforcement officers in Arizona questioning the enforcement of these procedures rather than asking it to go up to the next level.
Do you think now this will force sooner rather than later a federal discussion of immigration? Will the president take this up right away?
Gosh, you know, it's clear that the president has wanted to avoid this conversation, or at least has hoped that this conversation could be behind things like jobs creation, financial reform, all of the other things that were on his agenda post-healthcare reform. But this certainly is likely to put it out there in public discourse. Whether or not the White House will act on it, I doubt, because, again, this doesn't change this doesn't change the law around immigration. It changes the enforcement of immigration.
Mm-hmm. I thought that this gentleman made an interesting point in today's Times, which you probably saw. Mr. Hernandez Garcia said, all the jobs are here. There is nothing in Mexico, and now it is so violent. Who wants to go back? There's the matter. There it is. Who wants to go back? The jobs are here.
So I suppose there's a couple of ways to think about that. One, that's a deeply sort of American ethnocentric way of imagining the world, as though there are no cultural or familial or purposeful ties that people have to their own nation, which I suspect is certainly an empirical hypothesis. We could test it, but I don't think it's true. But the other thing is that it certainly does accurately link that questions of immigration and immigration reform are not solely matters of domestic policy. You can't exist in a small world as we exist in one, both economically small and small here, on our continent, and imagine that you could simply build a wall around your borders. That's just not how the world works. So part of how we will address questions of immigration in the United States has to do with our foreign policy and
yes.
our economic
mm-hmm.
foreign policy and the extent to which the world is a safer and prosperous place for people to live in nations where they are already deeply connected.
Well, let's move on to another small matter, financial overhaul bill, which is to be debated this week. Republicans are hoping to block this, and they say that they have the votes to do that, that there won't be a deal today. What is the breadth of this legislation, Professor Harris-Lacewell?
Well, it's hard to tell exactly what will come out of it. The Democrats really do need at least one Republican vote to move forward at this point. It looks like the anxiety on the Republican side at this moment has to do with dropping the derivatives. Now, let me just say, I am no financial expert. This is in part how I ended up a political scientist and not an economist. So I am always kind of running behind not only the news cycle, but also colleagues like Paul Krugman here at Princeton and John Lonergan, other really brilliant economists who are much better on this topic. But on the politics of it, what's happened with the passage of health care reform is that now financial reform is going to become the most proximate topic next to the midterm elections, right? Remember that American voters tend to have fairly short attention cycles. Health care reform has now cycled all the way through. And so Democrats and Republicans in local House and Senate races are likely to be battling this summer over questions of financial reform. Now, this is kind of an interesting position for Republicans to find themselves in. On the one hand, wanting to demonstrate their resistance to Democratic lawmakers so that they can indicate that they are a real alternative to the Democratic Party and win a significant seat gain in the House. On the other hand, they also, particularly pushed by the Tea Party on the right, they want to be the party of the people. They want to be the party that is concerned with how Main Street is doing. And so they also need to be part of passing reform and restrictions on Wall Street. So it's going to be a very difficult place for the Republican Party to balance, on the one hand, resisting Democrats, and on the other hand, demonstrating that they are aggressively for reform of Wall Street.
What about the anger on the part of the American people, Professor Harris-Lacewell? Where is it placed? How huge is it? It seems to me as though Americans have a legitimate right to be pretty furious at these institutions, which took massive amounts of our money and then are paying massive bonuses to the people who created the mess in the first place. It is something for us to be legitimately angry about.
So I don't know how useful anger is in social change. So let me just say that I certainly think that we need to be vigilant, concerned, and ask ourselves exactly who profits and who will need to give up some of that profiting in order to sort of set right a more egalitarian financial system in the United States. On the other hand, I'm a little worried about anger being infused as our main political emotion here, in part because I think it clouds our ability to see what solutions exist. So we're not against banking. We may just be against the consolidation into big banks and the movement away from local banks. It's not that we're against people making profits, not as Americans, but we are against a sort of hyper-profiting during a time of economic constriction for ordinary families. So I think that we need to be really clear about what it means. And let me say also that there's going to be a kind of philosophical element that emerges out of this, regardless of whatever anger or concern there is on the part of Americans, and that is Americans typically prefer egalitarian situations if that equality means taking the bottom and bringing it up, giving more to people who have less. Americans, by and large, are really loath, even in situations that seem deeply unfair, to take from the top. For at least 50 or 60 years now, we've thought of that kind of redistribution from the top to the middle as indicative of an ideology that we don't support. And I'm going to try not to say the word. And so I think we have to be really careful about how we approach this so that it still feels like a support of an American system of capitalism that says, listen, what we need is for Americans to feel like the dream still exists, that people who work hard can own a home, can raise families, can put their kids in quality public schools, and can have an opportunity to do better next year than they're doing this year. And that the way that the current banking and investment and mortgage situation operates, that dream is dying for most Americans. And it's dying so that a very, very few on the top can experience hyper profits. And that is what we see as the problem.
Right. And do we envision ourselves, as some would suggest, as someday being at the top ourselves, so we don't want to take away from those people because it might be us?
That seems to be the argument about why, for example, all Americans think of themselves as middle class, whether they make $10,000 a year or $10 million a year.
Right.
We have a real difficulty in this nation in describing class. In fact, even to discuss class is sometimes to be accused of inciting class warfare, as though ever such a thing existed in the United States, and often have difficulty building political coalitions around shared economic interests, in part because Americans tend to believe that their economic fortunes can change momentarily. The thing is, the more that the empirical evidence is against that, in other words, the more that Americans actually do labor for years and years and years and cannot get out of debt and cannot buy a home and cannot send their children to college, then the less likely they are to, you know, sort of be part of that imaginary conception of what America is.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the huge oil spill, which may threaten the Gulf, the land of the Gulf, sometime this week. What does that do to the president's stated policy of offshore drilling, which he says he's using to get to another place when it comes to cleaner forms of energy? Is this something that we really need to pay attention to, and it may keep that offshore drilling from proceeding?
Absolutely, we need to pay attention to this. So let me say, this is very personal for me. I do live half my life here in New Jersey, where I teach, but I live the other half of my life in New Orleans, in Louisiana. And the question of Gulf Coast environmental policy, which, of course, has at its core offshore drilling, has been central to both the advocacy work and teaching and research that I've been up to over the past 5 years, as well as just the very simple realities of having friends and loved ones and property in a place that is profoundly impacted by these kinds of environmental choices. We have got to ask ourselves, you know, whether or not we are really clear about the fact that this is a homeland security issue. This is a border issue. When we are destroying our wetlands, when we are invading our environmental situation with oil in this way, we have, and when we are dependent on oil, And whether it's foreign oil or offshore oil, our dependency on it makes us less safe as a nation, both in terms of things like storm surges and hurricanes, but also in terms of our ability to be shut down very easily if, in fact, these oil reserves are not widely available to us. So we have got to make dramatic behavioral changes, not only as households, but as businesses.
Mm-hmm. How is New Orleans doing from the perspective of somebody who lives there half the year? Are you pleased with the rebuilding progress, Melissa?
New Orleans is in a very interesting moment. We just elected a new mayor who will be taking office in about a month, actually just less than a month now. And I think many in the city are very excited about what new local leadership may provide and the fact that this new mayor will have, I think, initially more respect and contacts and relationships in Washington because Mayor Landrieu is, in fact, the brother of the Democratic senator from Louisiana, Mary Landrieu. So in certain ways, I think there's a great deal of hope that this will open up some more opportunities for engagement. I'll also say that I am happier now over the past 12 months or so after the Obama administration sort of got itself together and began sending its heads of important agencies like HUD, EPA, and others to New Orleans. The policies around things like housing, transportation, schools have much improved during the Obama administration. That said, the city is still vastly predominantly the leadership of the city. The good things that are happening because ordinary people have organized in that city. They've built nonprofit organizations, they've opened small businesses, and many of them in spite of the government, many of them doing it despite the fact that there's been very little help and assistance on a structural level, so tons of goodwill of American people. But the charity of and goodwill of American people and even the innovative strength and willingness of New Orleanians themselves is still not enough given the vast enormity of what that disaster is. And so the city is still, in many ways, just beginning to get to its feet.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell is our guest for All Things Political this week, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. We're talking about financial reform and immigration and offshore oil drilling, the state of New Orleans, and take us into new places if you'd like. She's Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, a frequent guest on MSNBC, and she writes for The Nation now. She writes a column for that, and she's also studying for her Master's of Divinity, so she's quite a busy woman. To your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with the director and producer of a very moving and important documentary film, Blessed is the Match, The Life and Death of Hannah Senish. At the age of 22 in 1944, she parachuted into Nazi-occupied Europe in an effort to save the Jews of Hungary, and she was captured, tortured, and killed by the Nazis. We'll be talking about Jewish resistance and the incredible life of Hannah Senish this second hour of our program. This hour is All Things Political with Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, and we start our calls with Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Good morning to you and to Professor Lacewell. I'd like to, if you'll indulge me, try to explain the deleterious effects that the TARP legislation is going to have on the black community, economically speaking. And just as part of that, I'd like to just have a little background here for people who may not know that during the presidential campaign, both then-Senator Obama and Senator McCain went back to Washington, D.C. to politic in favor of TARP, and they both voted for it. I understand Senator Obama actually contributed to the writing of the TARP legislation. Now, I'm an economics graduate of UW-Madison, and I've had a course in money and banking, so I know something about the Fed. TARP was not required for the Federal Reserve to bail out all these big banks. The Fed has been doing that ever since the 1930s. They can create money out of thin air, and they have all the regulatory power they need. The reason TARP was put through was at the request of these big banks, because it makes it impossible for lawyers to bring any lawsuits against these banks, not only for these bonuses that are so egregious, but also it won't be possible to bring significant lawsuits to change any of these subpar mortgages that, you know, are in the millions. And, you know, all these big banks, you know, they were all saved. They were all bailed out by the taxpayer. But the biggest group that took out these questionable loans were black people. And we already have 2 million foreclosures scheduled for this year. There are going to be millions of black families put out onto the street because of this TARP legislation.
All right, I need to hold you there, Jim, because we have tons of phone calls.
Right, I was just going to say, though, I'm sorry, because I did think that I was being asked about the new financial reform legislation,
right,
as opposed to TARP, which does make some changes around these. But there is no question that families of color were among the most difficult or hardest hit, and that we will and that, of course, we know that black and brown homeownership already lagged that of white homeownership, that many got into homes for the first time using these subprime mortgages and these kind of creative underwritings, and that in the context now of this economic downturn and this kind of mortgage financial crisis, that these are the families that are going to be hardest hit. Let me suggest that one of the things that will assist on this, that we have had for more than 30 years now a real aversion to, has been quality construction of rental homes for families. Although the American dream is to own one's own home, part of what's happened as we moved people solely into home ownership is that, particularly in urban areas where many families of color live, there haven't been adequate, reasonable, family-friendly rental opportunities for families, and that investing in building those, providing tax credits for those who will invest in building and maintaining quality rental units will be part of the solution to making sure that the mortgage crisis doesn't lead to a boom in a homelessness crisis.
And I was reading somewhere, Professor, that it would have made sense for a lot of people to rent, considering what happened to the home values and the money they lost for quite a long period. I don't know if that's still true or not, but I think you make a valid point that nobody talks very much about.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is, you know, it was an interesting reaction, for example, post-Katrina, that one of the, what I think, most horrifying moments of in post-Katrina New Orleans was when the city council, in part under pressure from the federal government via HUD, under the W administration, made a choice after Katrina, while there were thousands of homeless living right there in the city under the bridge near City Hall, made a choice to demolish every unit of public housing in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Now, public housing has always been housing for those who either are homeless or on the precipice of homelessness. And yet what's happened is that language like public housing ends up taking on such a normative value. So we say public housing, and somehow what that represents is crime and bad and, you know, all of these sort of horrible ideas in our head. And so we take it down, but of course taking it down means needing to funnel and force people into home ownership that they sometimes are not able to actually maintain. So young families with a single working parent would often be in much better circumstances if they could rent. But rental housing has been sort of off the agenda now for 30 years.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Lauren from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I'm kind of blown away by the professor's ability to deal with all of these different issues. This is it's been a very good morning. Let me say, my question is, are we at a point as far as financial regulation is concerned? They seem to be able to find, you know, we can say there won't be any more derivatives or they won't be handled this way, but the new derivative is going to be something completely different that's not going to be regulated, and they're always going to be trying to find ways to make more and more money. Is it to the point that we're going to have to say if you engage in a practice, regardless of what it is, with reckless abandon for, you know, recklessness for the whole economy or for a certain sector, that if you operate at that level, that this behavior is going to be criminalized? I mean, we can't just keep going and plugging every little hole that they come up with. Are we at the point where we're going to have to criminalize their behavior based on, you know, the recklessness from which they go after the economy or the economics?
Before Melissa responds, what do you think of that, Lauren? Do you think we should?
Well, I'm a criminal defense attorney. As a matter of fact, I've got to get off the phone shortly because I'm going up to the jail. But, you know, I see criminalized behavior all of the time, and I just don't really understand. These guys, far from being criminalized, I mean, they come back and they get million-dollar bonuses, which, you know, is, I'll be honest with you, is totally beyond anything I could comprehend as far as how that's justified. But, I really think that it has come to the point where you can't say, oh, whoops, we didn't realize that we're going to make so much money and everybody was going to suffer so much from derivatives or whatever it may be. I think you're going to have to start looking at these things and saying, yeah, I guess maybe we did get a little too close to the edge, and somebody's going to have to go off and do some time somewhere.
Hmm. I think that you made two really smart points. I mean, more than that, but two that I just want to highlight again. One is the fact that markets are flexible, and they're elastic, and they are likely to move into something new. So we are, in many ways, in financial reform, fighting the last war, right? So as you point out, we're going in and plugging a hole when likely what's going to happen is that markets, for the purposes of profiting, will simply move to something else, right? Something that we can't even at this moment imagine and legislate against. And, of course, we don't want to legislate against things that we can't even imagine. That's just sort of a bad way and a pretty authoritarian way to run a nation. On the other hand, this question about criminalizing, I think, certainly draws in this distinction between the ways that we criminalize relatively petty behavior on the parts on the part of ordinary citizens, and often the most poor and vulnerable citizens are most heavily punished for crimes that are certainly important, but rarely have such dramatic effects on the entire society. Whereas those with relatively more privilege are not only not punished, but sometimes are rewarded for their greed and rewarded for the ways in which they end up having these enormously negative effects on really hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. And so I think that does call us to a much more centrally ethical question about how we will live together in a nation and ask ourselves, What are the things that are truly dangerous to our common good, and what are the things that are more in the realm of human freedom? The fact is, right now we've behaved like petty street crime is the thing that's most dangerous to us, whereas kind of profiteering at the cost of millions of American jobs and home security is simply the realm of human freedom for the purposes of profiting. So I actually think it's a deep, deep ethical question.
Yes.
And not just a legal one.
Yes, very well put. Thank you so much, Lauren, for your call. We go to Jim from Milwaukee next. And our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell is our guest today for All Things Political. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wanted to talk about a 47-year-old white man, a waiter at a restaurant that I went to, and he told me that for the first time, his major restaurant chain is offering health insurance, and that he had never, ever been covered before in his life, but he was getting older, and he felt he ought to do something about that. And I want to splice that into immigrants and the attitudes that people have towards the working poor, especially in terms of resentment, because it's interesting to me how the people who set up the situation for people to be lacking then blame the victim and for the problem that they set up in the first place. And in right-wing talk radio, the way they do it is they'll talk about people who are freeloaders and bums who get benefits that other people earned and thereby bleed the rest of us white. And they ignore the situations that set up the circumstances in the first place. For example, immigrants were driven off the land in Mexico by NAFTA. Then they came to the United States for jobs, low wages without benefits. And also a lot of other working poor do not get benefits, of course. Now, the result of this is when these people go to the emergency room, we, the suckers, pay for the benefits that these people receive because the people that were selfish and the employers didn't give them the benefits in the first place. And so we go through a process of blaming the victim and playing on people's resentments when the victimizers are the ones that are the real freeloaders in the whole system.
Well, you know, it certainly is indicative that the capacity to control the narrative is at least as important as the policies and the actions themselves, right? So who appears to be the victim, who appears to be the sort of, villain versus the hero. And I do agree that one of the things that I think we often have difficulty doing in public discourse is talking about institutions and structures. It's much easier to talk about villains and heroes as individuals, you know, those bad, greedy people, or, you know, those poor, victimized people, whichever direction we would frame it. But sometimes all of the actors in a system can be basically good people, basically doing the best they can, but because of the way the structures are developed, it becomes very difficult for anyone to, you know, be doing the right thing. And I think healthcare is a really good example here. When healthcare is employer provided, rather than provided as a basic right to everyone in a nation, then it creates a situation where, of course, those who are outside of the system or those who are trying to start small businesses, have great difficulty. And so the system itself is set up against sort of both of the actors in your example.
What do you think? We spent so much time, as you well know, and you spent a lot of time talking about this as well, over a year talking about healthcare reform. It's not something that we're discussing much at all right now. What do you think most of us are thinking about this? Did it go far enough for us? Are we going to hold Democrats responsible for passing something that we didn't like come fall? What are we thinking about it? Are people benefiting from what passed, Professor?
Yeah, I mean, people will benefit, but it certainly, in my mind, did not go far enough. I call this the defending Stupak problem that we have on the left. So in part, the American left has become so truncated, so small, that it's hard to talk about our critiques of something being insufficiently progressive, because even the small bit of kind of centrist liberal policymaking that is going on gets attacked as being socialist or communist or, you know, somehow sort of outrageously an extension of the U.S. state, when in fact it's mostly not. And in fact, for those of us who would like to see maybe more of an extension of the U.S. state, you know, for example, through single-payer health care, which I think is ultimately the only thing that removes this kind of burden from employers and from citizens, you know, there's just very, very little room to talk about it. So I call it the defending Stupak problem because, of course, those of us who are also reproductive rights advocates were very angry about the Stupak Amendment and sort of the process of the Stupak Amendment through the health care reform process. And yet, at the very end, Stupak himself was being denigrated as a baby killer and said to have done all of these horrible things. And so, of course, we end up defending, right? I say we, I mean those of us in the reproductive rights movement, end up defending someone who we had actually been criticizing for months and months before just because it seemed so appalling that someone who had in fact been pro-life and had in fact been hoping to restrict women's access to reproductive care was being called a baby killer. And so I think that often happens, and it certainly happened in the healthcare reform debate, where the more progressive options were largely off the table from the beginning.
Let's talk more about that progressive voice. Do you fault the president for not being as progressive as some people thought he was? I don't know if he is progressive or not. I don't know what I'm asking here. But did you expect that he would be more progressive on certain issues? And had he been, would he been able to have moved forward more progressive legislation, or are the times just against that?
Yeah, no, I have to say, so Barack Obama is not a stranger to me as an elected official. I lived in Chicago for 7 years while I taught at the University of Chicago. I lived in Hyde Park, and Barack Obama was my state senator and then went on to become my U.S. senator. So in that sense, I was very clear that Barack Obama had spent a career as a centrist. And I respected, in fact, his work as a centrist legislator with some, progressive leanings here and there. I think one of my earliest media appearances was making a comparison between Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and suggesting that was a much better comparison than Barack Obama and Jesse Jackson. Because, of course, simply because he is African-American, many have wanted to lump him with a tradition of black political leadership, when in fact I think it's much more appropriate look at him as a kind of new Democrat, those Democrats that emerged in the early 1990s. So I'm not, you know, disappointed or upset or surprised. If anything, I suppose I'm more distressed that the space for public organizing and for pressure around legislative bodies, state offices, has come dramatically from the right instead of from the left. So my irritation is more with the left, who, after participating in the 2008 election and in the excitement and history of electing Barack Obama, largely went and took a nap afterward and has
right.
not remained mobilized, so that in places like New Jersey, we lost the gubernatorial race. And it's had very real consequences immediately in this state that it is Chris Christie instead of John Corzine as governor. And you see, you know, again, sort of, you know, Democratic friends saying, oh, really? I, you know, who knew it would make a difference? And so, you know, it's obviously not Barack Obama's fault when we don't stay mobilized in Massachusetts, when we don't stay mobilized in New Jersey. That's the responsibilities of Democratic citizenship. Requires hard work in a sustained way.
Well, that's interesting. I think it was Gail Collins who had an interesting piece over the weekend or last week sometime talking about this whole issue of how the Democrats, you know, people are saying the Democrats are going to lose the House come fall. But she was pointing out the quality of Republican candidates as well, which is something that isn't very much discussed. And some of these people may not have widespread support. Can you talk about that a little bit? We keep hearing, oh, the Democrats are going to lose everything. Who are the candidates who are going to win?
You just have to love Democrats. We just prefer to lose in certain ways. So we're just a hand-wringing bunch. So, I mean, a couple of things. Will the Democrats lose seats in the House? Probably. I mean, historically, the party in the White House always loses seats in the midterm. It's just that typically, they make it back up during the presidential election year. So even though you saw that pattern for more than 40 years, you didn't actually see a switch in the House in terms of leadership until the Republican Revolution under Newt Gingrich against Bill Clinton in the 90s. I think that this is more like normal politics. You'll see a loss of seats, but likely not a shift of the majority in the House. And part of the reason that that will happen is because the Tea Party mobilized activists on the right, and they are mobilized,
mm-hmm.
And it looks like they can actually turn out voters. They are vastly predominantly concentrated in areas that are already represented, for the most part, by Republicans. Now, you know, the Massachusetts case always makes people go, but they could take Massachusetts, but that was an off-midterm and off-presidential year election. In this election, it is most likely that what you will see is that the activism on the right will pull Republican candidates to the right, but that it will make only a marginal difference in the actual seats, because, again, the Tea Party is concentrated, for example, in the U.S. South and in other red states. And so because those are, and I don't just mean red in presidential elections, I mean red state delegations to the U.S. House of Representatives. So I actually think that the margins of victory may be higher for Republicans in those districts, but it's not likely to actually switch the majority in the House.
Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell is our guest, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, regular contributor to MSNBC, monthly columnist for The Nation, and we're taking phone calls. All right, we have one line open right now if you would like to get to be on the air. Call us now. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Bill Nye, the science guy, will join us. Last week, someone wanted to know more about the meteor which hit Wisconsin. Was it 2 weeks ago now? And all the people from all over the country who are coming to pick up pieces of the meteor. We'll talk about that and many other scientific topics with Bill Nye tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour. Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell is with us now. She is our All Things Political guest. We go to Daryl next from Exonia. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. I just wanted to say, you know, they wouldn't need financial regulation if they would have let capitalism do its job, and all these companies that made all these big wagers crashed and burned, and then those, you know, they would stop that behavior because they would have lost all their money, and those of us that have maybe been a little smarter with our wealth would have walked through the wreckage, and then we'd have bought houses at a lot cheaper. The market would have crashed. The market would set the prices. Housing would be cheaper. Rental would be cheaper. You wouldn't need to regulate these guys because they would have lost their money instead of stepping in. I mean, they changed the rules in the middle of the game. That's how capitalism is supposed to work. You take a gamble, you lose, you crash. Now they're artificially pumping up houses by $8,000 a piece. Every house that gets sold now is inflated by $8,000. You put $8,000 on your house, and you take out a loan, you really have lost you have no equity in that house because your $8,000 is really imaginary. I mean, that's not capitalism.
You know, it's an interesting claim, right? That precisely the sorts of losses that ordinary people are experiencing, go ahead and let the institutions experience them. Clearly, no one in Washington had the stomach for that, and I hear you about the wreckage. It's just that we do know that wreckage exists on the backs of human beings. So I'm also not sure that whether or not I think we should have had the stomach for it. But it is, I think, it's an interesting sort of question to ask. What does it mean, this sort of too big to fail? Maybe that's precisely that they were too big to succeed, and that we should have let them fail.
And then others have said if we had not stepped in, everything would have come crashing down. I don't know enough about economics to know that either.
Yeah, this is definitely a Paul Krugman question.
Right.
and we should get a minute. But one thing that I do very much like about what your caller just said is I think we have to be willing to put all of the possibilities on the table. I think we simply will be a more interesting nation and a more sort of nimble country if instead of imagining that things must be just as they are in terms of our political rules, our economic rules, that we just at least allow ourselves a little bit of public imagination about, well, what would it mean to simply go through a fire that we feel like we don't have the courage or the stomach for? What would that mean that we'd have to do? Does that mean that we'd need to pass a kind of social safety net so that when those kinds of crashes occur, people don't fall below a certain floor? Does it mean that we need to return to or maybe not return to, but create for the first time a sense of community where people are existing in more local enclaves instead of more global ones? Is that just a romantic way of imagining the world? I don't know, but I think, I'm a professor, so we like to play with ideas. So I appreciate that call for that purpose.
Yes. Thanks, Daryl. Sharon from Duluth. Hi.
Hi. I told your screener that sometimes we get a little bit away from a conversation before you can get through the call, but kind of was looking at the fellow that had brought up criminalizing some of these activities, and my thought was sometimes when there's a trial and someone has committed, like, even murder, and the result is they're found not guilty, people who have been hurt by that person can bring something called a civil suit and recoup money from the situation. And it occurs to me, is there any way, going to prison is one thing, but I think even if these guys went to prison or we don't have laws that would put them in prison, is there any way for any kind of civil suits to recoup? It seems really lopsided that they should be obviously immorally having gotten a lot of these gains, and then just able to walk away and keep all this money that they made.
Well, I certainly love that idea, and it also would really make for an awfully great film, kind of a... you just see the film sort of the American taxpayer in a class action lawsuit.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so the answer is, again, so this may be a moment when we want a legal expert to talk to us a little bit about what it would mean to think about a class standing in that way. But I think that's part of how we should, what we should be asking from the court that does in fact supposedly represent us as a national voice, and that's the Supreme Court. And so part of my anxiety is that when I look, for example, at the composition of the current Supreme Court and the decisions that are coming out of it, even at this moment where we have public anxiety about kind of raiding the public coffers financially, we also have a Supreme Court saying, and meanwhile, corporations will have the rights of individuals, the right of free speech in the way that individuals do, and therefore can make unlimited campaign contributions, or that they should be limited only in the ways that individuals are. And that is stunning. And the notion that there is that kind of role for corporate bodies, I think, should cause us as much pause and distress as the sort of the banks and the financial markets, right? What does it mean that we have the Supreme Court? So I don't know whether or not we can take them to court, but I do wish that the Supreme Court were acting in a way that represented the least of these rather than the most privileged. Hmm.
Do you have a suggestion for the president for the opening on the court?
No, I do, but it'll never happen. But God, I would love to see Kimberly Crenshaw on that court. Kimberly Crenshaw is an African-American woman law professor. She holds appointments at both UCLA Law and Columbia Law School. How she does that, I have no idea. She is also the intellectual founder of the idea of intersectionality, which is a concept that links the multiple identities that individuals have, race, class, gender, sexual orientation, for example, and asks how their connection in the law is sometimes on all of these bases. So I'll just give you a quick example. For example, fair housing cases have to be brought under a single claim. Either you're saying that someone was discriminated against because of their race, their gender, or their family status, for example. So if you have a single black mother, is she being discriminated against in this housing moment because of her race, her gender, or her family status? The truth is it's likely all of them, but the way that our current law operates, you can only sue under one. And as you might imagine, it means that if you can find an individual who shares one of those identities but not the other, who wasn't discriminated against, that can mean the end of the case. So Kim Crenshaw is an enormous talent. And by the way, she was also one of the leading activists organizing against the confirmation of Clarence Thomas. And so would just really love to see them on the court together. I would enjoy that so.
Ooh, that was a quick answer and thorough. Thanks. Let's go. Thanks, Sharon, for your call. Gil from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the recent column in The Nation by your guest that was based on what box Obama checked on the census form, and ask if she thinks that was a politically strategic decision or a personal decision on the way he identifies himself.
Oh, that's
and
a good question.
Why is it important at all?
Okay.
Well, so, yes, I did write a piece recently on The Nation, for The Nation magazine, for my column Sister Citizen, about the president choosing black and exclusively black as his self-identification on the census. And, you know, I think that in certain ways that's an empirical question about whether or not it was a politically strategic choice versus a personal one, and we could find out if we had his other census responses. So if he has for a long time been checking black, although actually that doesn't quite work because he would have only had an option to choose one for most of his life, right? You couldn't choose more than one option until fairly recently. So my bet is that he, like I, have always self-identified as African-American, as black, despite the fact that he and I both have a white mother. And it is a natural extension of his self-identification as well as his identification as the head of a household, a domestic unit, which includes an African-American woman and two African-American children, all of whom have a kind of sole racial identity. So, you know, I talk more about what I think the political ramifications or social meanings of that are in the article, but I think as a matter of choice, he was making that choice because my bet is that that's how he's self-identified for quite some time. And again, I'm informing that bet based on his own writings about his racial self-identification journey that he kind of maps for us in Dreams of My Father.
It's quite a journey, isn't it? I'm still so struck by his life. It is just phenomenal.
You know, it's funny. The new book, The Bridge,
yes,
by New Yorker editor, whose name is now leaving
David Remnick.
David Remnick. Gosh, mm-hmm. How did I forget that? You know, I have to say, I like the book in many ways, but I am irritated by precisely that sense of Obama's exceptionalism. And let me just say, I'm irritated by it in part because, not because I don't think that Barack Obama is exceptional. Of course I do, and I think he's in many ways the best of us from a political standpoint. But I do think he comes from an us, and that us is a group of post-civil rights generation, affirmative action generation, middle-class African-Americans who had an enormous world of opportunities open to us, despite the fact that we grew up in households that were kind of upper working class to lower middle class, who sometimes had moments of opportunity that allowed us to access structural and racial privilege by going, for example, to predominantly white schools or having a parent or grandparents who were white. I mean, his story is amazing, in part because he ends it in the White House.
Right.
But I got to tell you, he is one of a group. And that knowing from whence he comes, and that although the story is amazing, it is not entirely unique. I think missing that misses so much of the structural and racial transformations that have occurred in this country.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, the Hawaii, the Kansas, the Indonesia, the Kenya, the traveling through Pakistan.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I can beat it. My mom, my mother graduated from BYU in 1964. Her great-grandparents were Mormon pioneers who pushed a handcart across the West, and my father was college roommates with Stokely Carmichael.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
So, you know, I'm just saying, and I mean, I only say that to say that, you know, that'd make a pretty darn good book, too, as well,
right.
I think, actually, many, many of the stories of those of us who are part of a very unique moment in African America.
Get on that book, Melissa. I want to read it. Thank you so much for being with us. You're great.
Thanks.
Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, our guest for All Things Political. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production, and we have news coming up. We'll return with a fascinating story coming up next on the Ideas Network.